starting it from both ends. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out quite as I had hoped, but the idea was a good one. Now, if we might try the same kind of thing, not building a wall, of course, I mean going at Kaer Kadan from different ways. Fluda shrugged, not a little crestfallen that his own suggestion had been dismissed. But Ailanwy nodded. Yes, it's the only sensible thing. Glue snorted.
The only sensible thing is to get an army behind you. When I was a giant, I'd have been willing to help you, but I mean to have no part in this scheme.
The little man was about to say more, but a glance from the bard silenced him.
Never fear, said Fluda. You and I will be together at every moment. You'll be in good hands.
Now then, broke in Rune, impatient to speak again. There are five of us. Some should climb over the rear wall, the others enter at the gate. The young king rose to his feet, and his eyes flashed eagerly. Fluda Flam shall have the gates opened. Then, while the others attack from the far wall, I shall ride straight through the gates. Rune's hand had gone to his sword. His head was thrown back, and he stood before the companions as proudly as if all the kings of Mona were at his side. He spoke on, firmly and clearly, with such joyful enthusiasm that Ailanwy had no heart to stop him. But at last she interrupted.
"Rune, I'm sorry," Ailanwy said, "but—and I think Fluda will agree with me—you will serve better if you stay out of the actual fighting, unless it's absolutely necessary. That way you'll be on hand when you're needed, but it won't be quite so dangerous for you."
Rune's face clouded with disappointment and dismay.
"But, I say, you're not a prince any more," Ailanwy added, before Rune could continue his protest. "You're king of Mona. Your life isn't altogether your own, don't you see? You have a whole realm of people to think of, and we shan't let you take any more risks than you have to. You'll be in far too much danger as it is." "If Queen Teleria could have guessed the way things would turn out," Ailanwy added, "you wouldn't have sailed to Kaer Dalbyn in the first place."
"I don't see what my mother has to do with it," cried Rune. "I'm sure my father would have wanted—"
"Your father understood what it means to be a king," Ailanwy said gently. "You must learn as well as he did."
"Taran of Kaer Dalbyn saved my life on Mona," Rune said urgently. "I am in his debt, and it's a debt that I alone can pay."
"You owe another kind of debt to the fisherfolk of Mona," Ailanwy replied, "and theirs is the greater claim."
Rune turned away and sat dejectedly on a hummock, his sword trailing at his side. Fluda gave him an encouraging clap on the shoulder.
"Don't despair," said the bard. "If our friend Gwistle's eggs and mushrooms fail, you'll have more than your share of trouble. So will we all."
It was nearly dawn and bitter cold when the little band left the concealment of the thicket and moved stealthily toward the lightless castle. Each carried a share of Gwistle's mushrooms and eggs and a packet of his black, loamy powder. Making a wide circle, they now approached Kaer Kadan from its darkest, most shadowed side.
"Remember the plan," Fluda warned under his breath. "It must go exactly as we set it. When we are all in position, Gwistle is to pop open one of those famous mushrooms of his. The fire should draw the guards to the rear of the courtyard. That will be your signal," he said to Ailanwy and Rune. "Then, and not before, mind you, be ready to force the gates open as soon as possible, for I imagine we shall be rather in a hurry to get out. At the same time, I'll free Smoit's men locked up in the guard room. They'll help you, if you need them, while I make my way to the larder and loose our friends." "We must hope that villainous spider hasn't already taken them away somewhere. If he has, well, we shall have to make new plans on the spot. And you, old fellow," Fluda added to Gwistle, as the dark walls loomed ahead, "I think it's time for you to do as you promised."
Gwistle sighed heavily, and his mouth drooped more wretchedly than ever.
"I'm not up to climbing, not today. If only you could have waited. Next week, perhaps, or when the weather turns better. Well, no matter. There's little a person can do about it."
Still shaking his head dubiously, the gloomy creature set down the coils of rope he carried over his shoulder. The large fishhooks, taken from his bundle, he now attached at various angles to the end of a slender line. Fascinated, King Roon watched as Gwistle, with a deft movement, flung the line into the air. From the parapet high above came a faint, rasping sound, then a dry click as the hooks caught on a projecting stone. Gwistle tugged at the cord and slung the remaining coils of rope about his neck.
"I say," Roon whispered, "will that fishing line hold you?"
Gwistle sighed and looked mournfully at him.
"I doubt it."
Nevertheless, mumbling and moaning, he quickly hoisted himself into the air, hanging an instant before his feet found the stones of the wall. Pulling himself up on the line and scrabbling with his feet against the sheer side of the castle, Gwistle was soon out of sight.
"Amazing!" cried Roon.
The bard frantically cautioned him to silence. A moment later, the fishing line was hauled up, and the end of one of the heavier ropes came swinging down. The bard lifted Glue, who was protesting as loudly as he dared, and boosted him onto the dangling cord.
"Up you go," Fluda muttered. "I'll be right behind you."
Roon followed as the bard and the former giant disappeared into the shadows. Eilanwë seized the rope and felt herself rapidly drawn aloft. She swung herself over the parapet and dropped to a projecting ledge. Gwistle had already scuttled toward the rear of the castle. Fluda and Glue slid into the darkness below. King Roon grinned at Eilanwë and crouched against the cold stones. The moon was down, the sky had turned black. Amid the shadows of the silent buildings, the stables and the long dark mass, which Eilanwë guessed to be Smoit's great hall, the low flames of a watchfire gleamed. Farther along the parapet, in the direction of the gates, the figures of the guards stood motionless, drowsing.
"I say, it's dark enough," Roon whispered cheerfully. "We shan't need Gwistle's powder at this rate. I can hardly see as it is."
Eilanwë turned her eyes in the direction Gwistle had taken, waiting from one endless moment to the next for the signal. Roon was tensed, ready to fling himself down the rope. A shout rang from the courtyard. At the same instant, a cloud of crimson flame burst in the shadows of the great hall. Eilanwë jumped to her feet.
"Something's amiss," she cried. "Fluda attacks too soon."
It was only then that she saw a burst of fire at the far end of the castle. More shouts of alarm rose above the clatter of racing footsteps. But the warriors, Eilanwë saw with sinking heart, ran not to Gwistle's false attack, but to the great hall. The courtyard seethed with shadows. Torches sprang to light.
"Quickly," Eilanwë shouted. "The gates!"
Roon swung from the ledge. Eilanwë was about to follow him, when she glimpsed a bowman at one of the guard posts on the wall. He raced toward her, then halted to take aim. Hastily, Eilanwë drew a mushroom from her cloak and flung it at the warrior. It fell short and split against the stones. Fire spurted, blinding her. The flames leapt in a roaring, searing cloud. The bowman shouted in terror and staggered back. His arrow whistled past her head. The girl seized the rope and dropped into the courtyard below. Chapter 7 The King of Mona. In the larder, which had become a prison, Gergi was first to hear the shouts of alarm. Though muffled by the heavy walls, the cries brought him to his feet before the other companions were aware of the tumult beyond their cell. All night, fearing the arrival of Mag from one moment to the next, they had vainly sought escape. Exhausted from their efforts, they dozed fitfully by turns, hoping only to sell their lives dearly when the guards at last came for them.
"Fightings and smitings," Gergi cried. "Is it for weary, tired captives? Yes, yes, it must be. Yes, we are here."
He ran to the door and began shouting through the iron grating. Now Taran heard what seemed to be a clash of swords. Karl and King Smoit were quickly beside him. Gwydion had already reached the door in two strides and drew away the excited Gergi.
"Beware," Gwydion sharply warned.
"Fluda Flam may have found a way to free us, but if the castle is aroused, Mag may take our lives before our comrades can save us."
Footsteps rang outside. The lock of the heavy door began to rattle, and the companions fell back, crouched and ready to set upon their captors. The door was flung open. Into the cell burst Ailanwy.
"Follow me,"
she cried. In one upraised hand she held the brightly glowing bauble, and with the other pulled a sack from her belt.
"Take these. The mushrooms are fire, the eggs are smoke. Throw them at anyone who attacks you. And this powder, it will blind them."
"I couldn't find weapons," she hurried on. "I've set Smoit's warriors free, but Fluda's trapped in the courtyard. Everything's gone wrong. Our plan has failed." Smoit, bellowing in rage, dashed to the door.
"Away with your toadstools and rooster eggs," he roared. "My hands are all I need to wring a traitor's neck."
Gwydion sprang through the doorway. With Carl and Gurgi behind him, Taran sped after Ailanwy. From the corridors of the great hall, Taran raced into what was neither daylight nor darkness. Huge billows of dense, white smoke rose in the courtyard, blotting out the dawn sky. Like swaying, twisting waves, they shifted as the wind caught them, lifted a moment to show a struggling knot of warriors, then flooded back in an impenetrable tide. Here and there, roaring columns of fire writhed through the smoke. Losing sight of Ailanwy, Taran plunged into the swirling clouds. A warrior brought up his sword and slashed at him. Taran stumbled to escape the blow. With outflung hand, he cast his small store of powder in the man's face. The warrior fell back as if stunned. His wide-open eyes stared blankly at nothing. Taran snatched the blade from the baffled guard and raced on.
"A smite! A smite!"
The red-bearded king's war cry rang from the stables. Before smoke filled his eyes again, Taran caught a fleeting glimpse of the furious Smoit, armed with a huge scythe and laying about him like a bear-turned-harvester. The luckless Gurgi, however, had stumbled with his egg still clutched in his hands. Smoke poured over him. For an instant, all Taran could see of him was a pair of waving, hairy arms before these, too, vanished in the billows. Yelling at the top of his voice, Gurgi spun about and dashed frantically wherever his feet led him. Warriors shouted and fled from this fearsome whirlwind. King Smoit, Taran realized, was trying to rally his own men around him, and Taran attempted to fight his way toward the stables. Carl briefly was at his side. The stout warrior had just gained a blade from a fallen opponent. Flinging aside the hoe, which until then had served him as a weapon, Carl threw his bulk against the press of swordsmen besetting Fluda Flam. Taran leapt into the fray, striking left and right with telling blows. Mag's warriors fell back. The bard joined Taran as they raced across the court.
"Where is Rune?" Taran cried.
"I don't know," Fluda gasped. "He and Ailanwy were to open the gates for us, but great Belin... What's happened since then, I can't guess. Everything has changed. One of Mag's men trod on glue, and we were discovered before we could go another step. From then on, the fat was in the fire. Where glue is now, I have no idea, though the little weasel gave a fair account of himself, I must say. So did Gwistle."
"Gwistle?" Taran stammered. "How?"
"Never mind," replied Fluda. "We'll tell you later, if there is a later."
They had nearly reached the stables. Taran caught sight of Gwydion. The Prince of Don's wolf-grey head towered above the milling warriors. But Taran's relief at Gwydion's safety turned to despair. He saw through the shifting clouds the tide of battle was turning against the companions. Only a handful of Smoit's men had been able to rally for an attack. The others were cut off, locked in combat throughout the courtyard.
"To the gates," Gwydion commanded. "Fly, all who can."
With sinking heart, Taran realized the little band was grievously outnumbered. Dimly, Taran saw the gates had been opened, but more of Mag's warriors had joined their fellows, and the way to safety was blocked. Suddenly, a mounted figure galloped into the courtyard. It was Rune, astride his dapple grey. The King of Mona's boyish face shone with a furious light. As the steed reared and plunged, Rune swung his sword about his head and shouted at the top of his voice,
"Bowmen, follow me! All of you into the court!"
He spun the mare about and beckoned with his sword. His words rang above the clash of arms.
"Spearmen, this way!
Make haste!
He's brought help, Taran cried.
Help? Echoed the amazed bard. There's no one within miles.
Rune had not ceased to gallop back and forth amid the struggling warriors, shouting orders as if a whole army streamed behind him. Mag's men turned to face the unseen foe.
A ruse! Exclaimed Fluda. He's a madman. It will never work.
But it does. At a glance, Taran saw their assailants had broken away, seeking in confusion to engage what they imagined to be fresh attackers. Taran brought his horn to his lips and sounded the charge. Mag's men faltered, believing the foe was now at their backs. At that instant, Lian burst through the gates. The men who saw her shouted in terror as the huge cat leapt forward. Lian paid no heed to the warriors, but raced across the court while the swordsmen dropped their weapons and fled at her approach.
"She's looking for me," Fluda cried. "Here I am, old girl."
King Smoit's embattled fighting men seized this moment to press forward with a mighty surge. Many of Mag's warriors had already flown. Fear-driven, they slashed and stabbed among themselves in blind panic. Rune galloped on and vanished into the smoke.
"He's duped them well," Fluda shouted jubilantly. "For all the good those eggs and mushrooms did us, it was Rune who turned the trick."
The bard hastened to Lian. Gwydion, Taran saw, was now on horseback. Golden-maned Melengar streaked across the courtyard as Gwydion urged the mare to overtake the retreating foe. Smoit and Carl had also leapt astride their steeds. Behind them galloped Gwistel. Smoit's warriors, too, joined the pursuit. Taran ran to find Melinless, but before he reached the stables, he heard Ailanwy call his name. He turned. The girl, her face smudged, her robe torn, beckoned urgently.
"Come," she called. "Rune is badly hurt."
Taran raced to follow her. Near the far wall, the dapple grey stood riderless. The King of Mona was sitting on the ground, his legs stretched in front of him, his back resting against a cart, still smouldering from Gwistel's fiery mushrooms. Gurgi and Glu, both unharmed, were at his side.
"Hello, hello," Rune murmured and waved a hand. His face was deathly white.
"The day is ours," Taran said. "Without you, it would have gone differently." "Don't move," he cautioned, loosening the young king's blood-stained jacket. Taran frowned anxiously. An arrow had sunk deep in Rune's side, and the shaft had broken.
"Amazing," Rune whispered. "I've never been in battle before, and I wasn't sure of anything at all. But I say, the oddest things kept running through my head. I was thinking of the seawall at Mona Haven. Isn't it surprising?" "Yes. Your plan will work very well," Rune murmured.
His eyes wandered, and suddenly he looked very young, very lost, and a little frightened.
"And I think I shall be glad to be home."
He made an effort to raise himself. Taran bent quickly to him. Fluda had come up with Lian loping at his heels.
"So there you are, old boy,"
he called to Rune.
"I told you we'd have more than our share of trouble, but you pulled us out of it. Oh, the bards will sing of you."
Taran lifted a grief-stricken face. "The King of Mona is dead." Silent and heavy-hearted, the companions raised a burial mound a little distance from Caer Cadarn. The warriors of Smoit joined them, and at dusk, horsemen bearing torches rode slowly circling the mound to honour the King of Mona. As the last flame died, Taran came to stand before the burial place. "Farewell, Rune, son of Rudlam." "Your sea wall is unfinished," he said gently, "but I promise you your work shall not be left undone. Your fisherfolk shall have their safe harbour, if I must build it for you with my own hands." Soon after nightfall, Gwydion, Carl, and King Smoit returned. Mag had eluded them, and the fruitless pursuit had left them worn and haggard. They too mourned the death of Rune, and did honour to all the fallen warriors. Gwydion then led the companions to the great hall.
"Aron, Deathlord, gives us little time for grief, and we shall mourn others, I fear, before our tasks are done," he said. I must tell you now of a choice carefully to be weighed. Gwystl of the Fair Folk has left us, and continues his journey to King Idileg's realm. Before we parted, he told me further of the gathering of Aron's hosts. Mag's words were not evil boasting. Gwystl judges, as do I, that Aron means to defeat us in one last battle. His armies gather even now. There is grave risk, and perhaps fatal risk, in leaving Durnwin in Aron's grasp, Gwydion went on. Yet we must face the more pressing danger. No longer will I seek the black sword. Whatever strength it may yield him, in my own strength I will stand against him to the death. I ride not to Anuvin, but to Caer Dathil, to rally the sons of Don. No one spoke for some moments. At length, Carl replied,
To my mind, you have chosen wisely, Prince of Don.
Smoit and Fluda Flam nodded their agreement.
Would that I were as sure of my wisdom, Gwydion replied heavily.
So be it then.
Taran rose and faced Gwydion. Is there no way one of us can breach the Death Lord's stronghold? Must the search for Durnwin indeed be given up?
I read your thoughts, Assistant Pigkeeper, Gwydion replied. You will serve me best if you obey my commands. Gwystl warns that a journey to Anuvin can mean only wasted life, and more than that, a loss of precious time. Gwystl's nature is to conceal his nature, but among the fair folk none is shrewder or more trustworthy. I heed his warning, and so must all of you.
Gwystl has promised to do all in his power to gain help from the fair folk, Gwydion went on. King Idileg has no great fondness for the race of men, yet even he must see that Aron's victory would blight all Prydain. The fair folk would suffer no less than we. But we dare not count too heavily on Idileg. Our own armies must be gathered, and our battle host raised. In this, our greatest help will come from King Pryderi of the West Domains. No lord in Prydain commands a mightier army. His allegiance to the House of Don is firm, and between us are strong bonds of friendship. I will send word to Pryderi, and pray him to join his host with ours at Caer Dathil.
There must we all meet, Gwydion continued. Before then, I ask King Smoit to muster every loyal warrior in his Cantrev, and the dominions closest to his.
He turned to the bard.
Fluda Flam, son of Godo, you are a king in your own northern realms. Return there without delay. To you I entrust the rallying of the northern Cantrevs.
And you, Assistant Pigkeeper, Gwydion said, seeing the question in Taran's eyes.
Your own task is urgent.
You are well known to the folk of the Free Comets. I charge you to raise whatever force you can among them. Lead all who will follow you to Caer Dathil. Gurgi and Carl, son of Kalfrur, will ride with you. So too will the Princess Ailanwy. Her safety is in your hands.
I'm glad, Ailanwy murmured, there's been no talk of sending me home.
Gwystl tells us many of Aron's liegemen are already marching, Carl said to her. The valley cantrevs are too dangerous, whatever. Otherwise, Princess, he added with a grin, you would long since have been on your way to Caer Dalban.
Well before dawn, Gwydion and Fluda Flam rode from Caer Cadarn, each to follow his separate path. King Smoit, girded for battle, set out from the castle, and with him went Lord Gast and Lord Gorion, who had learned belatedly of the attack on their king and now hastened to join him. Faced with the common danger, the two rivals had put aside their quarrel. Gorion declined to take insult at Gast's every word. Gast refrained from giving offence to Gorion, and neither so much as mentioned cows. That same morning, a gnarled, grey-headed farmer strode up to Taran in the castle courtyard. It was Eden, who had befriended him long before in Smoit's Cantrev. The two clasped hands warmly, but the farmer's face was grim.
"There is no time now to speak of time past," Eden said.
I offer you friendship, and this, he added, unsheathing a rusted sword. It has served once and can serve again. Say where you ride, and I will go with you.
I value the sword, and value more the man who bears it, answered Taran.
But your place is with your king. Follow him and hope that you and I will meet on a happier day.
As Gwydion had ordered, Taran and the remaining companions waited at Smoit's castle, hoping Cor might arrive with further tidings. But when the following day brought no sign of the crow, they made ready for their own departure. Ailanwy's needlework had gone unscathed, and she carefully unfolded it. "You're a war leader now," she said proudly to Taran, "but I've never heard of a war leader without a battle flag." With leather thongs, she bound the still unfinished embroidery to the end of a spear.
"There," said Ailanwy,
"as an emblem Henwen may not be properly terrifying, and yet, for an assistant pig-keeper, she's very likely the most fitting."
They rode through the gates. Gurgi, at Taran's side, raised the spear high, and the wind caught at the banner of the white pig. Above the smoke-blackened fortress and the burial mound, whose fresh earth was already frost-covered, the clouds had grown heavy. Soon there would be snow. Chapter 8 The Messengers. From the moment he left Caer Dalvin, Cor had flown directly toward Anuvin. Though it was the bird's pleasure aloft to revel in the limitless reaches of the sky, to swoop and soar above the white sheep flocks of clouds, he now put aside all temptation to sport with the wind and held steadily to his course. Far below, Averin glinted like a long trickle of molten silver. Fallow fields spread in patches. The treetops rose black and leafless, broken by dark green stretches of pine forest following the curves of the hills. Cor pressed ever northwestward, resting seldom during the hours of daylight. Only at dusk, when even the crow's keen eyes could not search beyond the gathering shadows, did he drop to earth and find haven among the branches of a tree. Days he flew high above the clouds to profit from the wind tides that bore him swiftly as a leaf in a stream. But, as he passed over the forest of Idris, drawing closer to the harsh peaks of Anuvin, Cor checked his gliding flight and dove earthward, alert for any stirring among the mountain passes. Shortly he glimpsed a column of heavily armed warriors marching northward. At closer range he saw them to be huntsmen of Anuvin. For a time he followed them and, when they halted amid the scrub and stunted trees, flapped to a low branch and settled there. Squatting at their cook fires, the huntsmen prepared their midday meal. The crow cocked his head and listened intently, but their muttered speech told him little, until he heard the words, "Caer Dathil." Cor shifted his position and cast about for a closer branch. One of the huntsmen, a brutish warrior garbed in bearskin, caught sight of the bird. Grinning cruelly at this chance for sport, the warrior reached for his bow and knocked an arrow to the string. Quickly he aimed and loosed the shaft. Rapid though the huntsman's movements were, the crow's sharp eyes followed them as quickly. Cor flapped his wings and dodged the arrow, then went rattling through the dead branches a little distance over his head. The huntsman cursed both his lost arrow and the crow, and made to draw again. Delighted with himself, jeering raucously, Cor sped above the trees, intending to circle back and find a safer listening post. It was then the Gwythaints appeared. For an instant, bent on returning to the huntsman's camp, Cor did not see the flight of the three huge birds. From a bank of clouds they plunged downward in a rush of black, beating wings. Cor's self-satisfaction vanished. The crow veered from their attack and strove desperately to climb higher, not daring to allow the deadly creatures to command the air above him. The Gwythaints, too, swiftly veered. One broke from his fellows to pursue the fleeing crow. The others, with powerful strokes of their wings, rose toward the clouds to renew their assault. Cor forced himself ever upward, and the Gwythaint had gained only slightly when the crow burst through a sea of mist into a sun-swept vastness that nearly blinded him. The other two Gwythaints were waiting. Shrieking in fury, they dropped toward him. Behind the crow, his pursuer drove him closer to the oncoming creatures. Cor glimpsed the flash of glistening beaks and blood-red eyes. The Gwythaint's screams of triumph ripped the empty sky. The crow suddenly checked his flight, feigning confusion,
When the Gwythaints were nearly upon him, he summoned all his strength in a single lunge that carried him beyond the talons, slashing like daggers. The crow had not gone unscathed. One of the Gwythaints had struck him beneath the wing. Despite the pain that dizzied him, Kor fluttered free of his attackers. The open sky was no refuge for him. No longer could he rely on swiftness of flight to save him. He plunged earthward. The Gwythaints were not outwitted. The scent of blood had maddened them, and they would not be deprived of their kill. They streaked after the crow to overtake and prevent him from reaching the forest below. The highest trees rose up toward Kor. He avoided them to drop closer to the underbrush. The tangle of branches slowed his pursuers. Without slackening speed, Kor skimmed above the ground, deeper and deeper into the maze of bushes. The huge wings of the Gwythaints, which had served so well aloft, now kept them from their prize. They screamed in rage, but made no attempt to venture farther into the woods. The crow, like a fox, had gone to earth. The day had begun to fade. Kor settled himself painfully for the night. At dawn, he fluttered cautiously to a treetop. The Gwythaints had gone, but his senses told him he had been driven far east of Anuvin. Stiffly, he launched himself from the tree and flapped his way aloft. Southward, Caer Cadarn lay beyond the reach of his ebbing strength. He must decide quickly, while life still remained to him. Kor circled once, then flew heavily toward his new goal and his only hope. His flight was now a constant torment. Often his wings faltered, and only the wind tides held him aloft. He could no longer travel a full day's distance. Long before sundown, his wound forced him to alight and hide himself amid the trees. Nor could he fly closer to the sun's warmth, but made his way only a little above the ground, nearly brushing the treetops. Below him, the countryside was springing to life with warriors, both on horseback and afoot. During the times he halted to husband his strength, he learned their destination, like that of the huntsman, was the fortress of the Sons of Don. His alarm grew sharper than his pain, and he flew onward. At length, in the numbing cold of the mountains northeast of the River Estrad, he dimly spied what he had been seeking. Surrounded by sheer walls of cliffs, the valley was a green nest amid the snow-capped summits. A small cottage came into sight. The blue surface of a lake flashed in the sunlight. Against the protected side of a hill slope stretched a long, boat-like shape, the vessel's ribs and timbers overgrown with moss. Beating his wings feebly, Kor dropped like a stone into the valley. He was vaguely aware, as his eyes closed, of jaws firmly about him, lifting him from the grass. Then a deep voice asking,
"Now, Brynach, what have you brought us?"
The crow knew nothing more. When he opened his eyes again, he lay upon a soft nest of rushes in a sunny chamber. He was weak, but his pain had left him, his wound had been bound up. As he feebly fluttered his wings, a pair of strong hands deftly reached to hold and calm him.
"Gently, gently," said a voice. "I fear you will be earthbound for a time."
The man's white-bearded face was as gnarled and weathered as an ancient oak in a snowdrift. White hair hung below broad, knotted shoulders, and a blue gem sparkled from the golden band circling his brow. Kor, without his customary squawking and jabbering, humbly bowed his head. Never before had he flown to this valley, but his heart had always known such a refuge awaited him. A secret sense, like some hidden memory he shared with all the forest creatures of Prydain, had guided him unerringly, and the crow understood he had come at last into the abode of Medwin.
Let me see,
Medwin continued, knitting his heavy brows in search of something long stored in a corner of his mind.
You would be, yes, the family likeness is unmistakable. Kor, son of Cadwir. Yes, of course. Forgive me for not recognizing you immediately, but there are so many crow clans, I sometimes get them mixed. I knew your father when he was a spindly-legged fledgling.
Medwin smiled at his own recollections.
The rogue was no stranger to my valley, A broken wing to be mended, a leg out of joint, one scrape after the other.
I hope you do not follow his example, Medwin added.
I have already heard much of your bravery and a certain bent, shall we say, for boisterousness. It has reached my ears as well that you serve an assistant pig-keeper at Caer Dalban. Mellinlass is his name, I believe. No, forgive me, that is his steed. Of course, Mellinlass, son of Melingar. The pig-keeper's name escapes me at the moment, but no matter. Serve him faithfully, son of Cadwyr, for his heart is good. Among all the race of men, he was of the few I allowed within my valley. As for you, I judge you and the Gwythaints have been at close quarters. Have a care. Many of Aron's messengers rove aloft these days. But you are safe now, and will soon be up and winging.
Perched on the back of Medwin's chair, an enormous eagle studded the crow. Beside the old man, the wolf Brinach sat on his haunches. Lean and grey, with yellow eyes, he wagged his tail and grinned up at the crow. A moment later, another wolf, smaller and with a white blaze on her breast, trotted in and crouched beside her mate.
"Ah, Briavel," said Medwin. "Have you come to greet our visitor? Like his father, no doubt, he will have a bold tale to tell us."
Cor spoke then in his own tongue, which Medwin easily understood. The old man's features turned grave as he listened. When the crow had finished, Medwin was silent for a time, deeply frowning. Brinach whined uneasily.
"It is come," Medwin said heavily. "I should have so guessed, for I sense a strange fear among the animals. More and more find their way here, fleeing what they themselves only dimly know. They tell of huntsmen abroad in force, and armed men. Now I understand the meaning of these tidings. The day I had ever feared has come upon us, yet my valley cannot hold all who would seek refuge."
Medwin's voice had begun to rise like a wrathful gale.
"The race of men face the slavery of Anuvin. So too the creatures of Prydain. In the shadow of the land of the dead, the nightingale's song will choke and die. The galleries of badgers and moles will become prison houses. No beast, no bird will roam or fly with the joy of a free heart. Those who are not slain, theirs will be the fate of the Gwythaints, long ago made captive, tormented, broken, and their once gentle spirits twisted to Aron's vile ends."
Medwin turned to the eagle.
"You, Edinion, fly swiftly to the mountain eyries of your kindred. Bid them rise up in all their strength and all their numbers. You, Brinach, and you, Briavel," he commanded as the wolves pricked up their ears, "spread the alarm among your own brethren, among the bears, with paws to smite and arms to crush, among the sharp-antlered stags, and all forest dwellers, large and small."
Medwin had risen to his full height, his hands clenched as tree roots clench the earth. The crow watched, awestruck and silent. Medwin's eyes flashed, and his deep voice came as a wave of thunder.
"Speak to them in my name, and tell them, such are the words of one who built a ship when the dark waters flooded Prydain, of one who bore their ancient sires to safety. Now, against this flood of evil, each nest, each lair, must be a stronghold. Let every creature turn tooth, beak, and claw against all who serve Aron, Death Lord."
Side by side, the wolves loped from the cottage, and the eagle took flight. Chapter 9. The Banner. Light snow fell before the companions had journeyed a day from King Smoit's castle, and by the time they reached the valley of Istrad, the slopes were white-cloaked, and ice had begun to sheathe the river. They forded while frozen splinters cut at the legs of their horses, and wended through the bleak hill cantrevs, pressing eastward toward the free comets. Of all the band, Gurgi suffered most grievously from the cold. Though bundled in a huge garment of sheepskin, the unhappy creature shivered wretchedly. His lips were blue, his teeth chattered, and ice droplets clung to his matted hair. Nevertheless, he kept pace at Taran's side, and his numbed hands did not loosen their grip on the banner. Days of harsh travel brought them across Small Averin to Senarth, where Taran had chosen to begin the rallying of the Comet Folk. But even as he rode into the cluster of thatch-roofed cottages, he saw the village thronged with men, and among them, Hevid the smith, barrel-chested and bristle-bearded, who shouldered his way through the crowd and clapped Taran on the back with a hand that weighed as much as one of his own hammers.
"A good greeting to you, wanderer," called the smith. "We saw you afar and gathered to welcome you."
"A good greeting to good friends," Taran replied. "But I bring a stern task in exchange for a warm welcome. Hear me well," he went on urgently. "What I ask is not asked lightly, nor granted lightly. The strength of your hands and the courage of your hearts, and, if it must be, even your lives." As the Comet Folk, murmuring, pressed around him, Taran spoke of what had befallen Gwydion and of the rising of Arawn. When he had finished, the men were grim-faced, and for a long moment all stood silent. Then Hevid the smith lifted his voice.
"The folk of the Three Comets honour King Math and the House of Dawn," he said. "But they will answer only to one they know as a friend, and follow him not in obligation, but in friendship. And so let Hevid be the first to follow Taran Wanderer."
"All follow, all!" cried the Comet men as with a single voice, and on the instant the once peaceful Senarth stirred like a gathering storm as each man hastened to arm himself. But Hevid gave Taran and the companions a hard grin.
"Our will is strong, but our weapons lack," he declared. "No matter, Wanderer. You toiled bravely in my smithy. Now shall my smithy toil for you. And I will send word to every metalsmith in the Comet Lands to labour as hard for you as I myself will do."
While the men readied their mounts and Hevid set his forge to blazing, Taran led the companions to the neighbouring comets. His task became quickly known, and each day brought its throng of herdsmen and farmers, who needed no urging to march in the growing host following the banner of the White Pig. For Taran, days and nights merged into one another. In the marshalling camps, astride unflagging Melinlass, he rode among the gatherings of peaceful men turned warriors, seeing to their provisions and equipment, and by the embers of watchfires held counsel with the new-formed warbands. When he had accomplished all he could at Senarth, Hevid rejoined Taran to serve as his master armourer. "You have done your work well, but we still go too lightly armed," Taran said, speaking apart with the smith. "I fear all the forges in Prydain will not be enough to serve our need. Somehow I must find a way."
"And so you shall, with luck," called a voice.
Taran turned to see a horseman who was riding up beside him, and blinked in surprise, for this was the strangest garbed of all the Comet warriors. The man was tall, lank-haired, with legs as spindly as a stork's, and so long they almost touched the ground on either side of his mount. Bits of iron and odds and ends of metal were stitched closely all over his jacket. He carried a wooden staff with a scythe blade at the end. On his head he wore what once had been a cookpot, now worked and shaped into a makeshift helmet that sat so low on the man's forehead it nearly covered his eyes.
"Lonio!"
Taran cried, warmly clasping the new arrival's hand. "Lonio, son of Lonwen!"
"None other,"
answered Lonio, pushing back his peculiar headpiece. "Did you not suppose I'd be along sooner or later?" "But your wife and family," Taran began. "I would not ask you to leave them. Why, of children I remember half a dozen."
"And another merrily on the way," Lonio replied, grinning happily. "Perhaps twins with my kind of luck. But my brood will be safe enough till I return. Indeed, if there is ever to be safety in Prydain, I must follow the wanderer now. But your concern is not babes in arms, but men at arms." "Hear me, friend wanderer," Lonio went on. "I have seen pitchforks and hayrakes among the Comet Folk. Could not the tines be cut off and set in wooden shafts?
Thus would you gain 3, 4, and even more weapons, where you had only one to begin with.
Why, so we could, burst out Hevid. How did I not see that myself?
No more did I, admitted Taran. Lonio sees more sharply than any of us, but calls luck what another would call keen wits. Go, friend Lonio, find what you can. I know you'll find more than meets the eye. As Lonio, with the help of Hevid the smith, gleaned the comets for sickles, rakes, fire-tongs, scythes, and pruning-hooks, and found ways to make even the most unlikely objects serve a new purpose, the store of weapons grew. While each day Taran rallied followers in greater numbers, Karl, Gergi, and Ilanwi helped load carts with gear and provisions, a task by no means to the liking of the princess, who was more eager to gallop from one comet to the next than she was to plod beside the heavy-laden wagons. Ilanwi had donned men's garments and braided her hair about her head. At her belt hung a sword and short dagger wheedled from Hevid the smith. Her warrior's garb was ill-fitting, but she took pride in it and was therefore all the more vexed when Taran refused to let her go afield. "You'll ride out with me," Taran said, as soon as the pack animals attended and their load secured. The princess reluctantly agreed, but next day, when Taran cantered past the horse lines at the rear of the camp, she furiously cried to him,
"You've tricked me! These tasks will never be done! No sooner do I finish with one string of horses and carts than along come some more! Very well, I shall do as I promised, but war leader or no, Taran of Caer Dalbyn, I'm not speaking to you."
Taran grinned and rode on. Bearing northward through the valley of Great Averon, the companions entered Comet Gwenith, and had scarcely dismounted when Taran heard a crackling voice call out,
"Wanderer, I know you seek warriors, not crones, but tarry a moment and give a greeting to one who has not forgotten you."
Dwivach, the weaver woman of Gwenith, stood in her cottage doorway. Despite her white hair and wizened features, she looked as lively and untired as ever. Her grey eyes scanned Taran sharply, then turned to Ilanwi. The ancient weaver woman beckoned to her.
"Taran Wanderer, I know well enough. And who you may be, I can guess well enough, even though you go in the guise of a man, and your hair could stand a little washing."
She glanced shrewdly at the princess.
"Indeed, I was sure, when the Wanderer and I first met, that he had a pretty maiden in his thoughts."
"Humph," Ilanwi sniffed. "I'm not sure if he did then, and even less sure if he does now."
Dwivach chuckled.
"If you are not, then no one else can be. Time will tell which of us is right. But meanwhile, child," she added, unfolding a cloak she held in her withered hands and setting it about Ilanwi's shoulders, "take this as a gift from a crone to a maiden, and know there is not so much difference between the two. For even a tottering grandam keeps a portion of girlish heart, and the youngest maiden a thread of old woman's wisdom."
Taran had now come to the cottage door. He warmly greeted the weaver woman and admired the cloak she had given Ilanwi. "Hevid and the comet smiths labour to make arms for us," he said, "but warriors need warmth as much as weapons. Alas, we have no garments like this."
"Do you think a weaver woman less hardy than a metalsmith?"
Vivac replied.
"As you wove patiently at my loom, now my loom will weave the more quickly for you. And in every comet, shuttles will fly for the sake of Taran Wanderer."
Heartened by the weaver woman's promise, the companions departed from Gwenith. A short distance from the comet, Taran caught sight of a small band of horsemen riding toward him at a quick pace. Leading them was a tall youth, who shouted Taran's name and raised a hand in greeting. With a glad cry, Taran urged Menelas to meet the riders.
"Lassa," Taran called, reining up beside the young man. "I did not think you and I would meet so far from your sheepfold in Comet Isav."
"Your news travels ahead of you, Wanderer," Lassa replied. "But I feared you would deem our comet too small and pass it by." "It was I," he added with shy hesitation that could not altogether conceal his boyish pride. "It was I who led our folk to find you."
The size of Isav is no measure of its courage, Taran said, and I need and welcome all of you.
But where is your father? He asked, glancing at the band of riders. Where is Drudwas? He would not let his son journey so far without him.
Lassa's face fell.
The winter took him from us. I grieve for him, but honour his memory by doing what he himself would have done.
And what of your mother? Taran asked, as he and Lassa trotted back to join the companions. Was it her wish, too, that you leave home and flock?
Others will tend my flock, the young shepherd answered. My mother knows what a child must do and what a man must do. I am a man, he added stoutly, and have been one since you and I stood against Dorath and his ruffians that night in the sheepfold.
Yes, yes, cried Gurgi. And fearless Gurgi stood against them too.
I'm sure all of you did, Ailanmi remarked sourly, while I was curtsying and having my hair washed on Mona. I don't know who Dorath is, but if I should ever meet him, I promise you I'll make up for lost time.
Taran shook his head. Count yourself lucky you don't know him. I know him all too well, to my sorrow.
He has not troubled us since that night, said Lassa,
nor will he likely trouble us again. I have heard he has left the Comet Lands and roves westward. He has put his sword in the service of the Death Lord, it is said. Perhaps it may be so, but if Dorath serves anyone, it is himself.
Your service, freely given, counts more for us than any the Lord of Anuvin could hire, Taran said to Lassa. Prince Gwydion will be grateful to you.
To you, rather, said Lassa. Our pride is not in fighting, but in farming, in the work of our hands, not our blades. Never have we sought war. We come now to the banner of the White Pig, because it is the banner of our friend, Taran Wanderer.
The weather worsened as the companions continued through the valley, and the growing host of Comet men forced them to travel at a slower pace.
The days were too short for the work to be done, but Taran rode grimly on. Beside him galloped Karl, uncomplaining and ever cheerful. His broad face, reddened and roughened by cold and wind, was nearly hidden by the collar of a great fleece-lined jacket. A sword belt of heavy iron links bound his girth, and at his back hung a round shield of oxhide. He had found a helmet of beaten metal, but deemed it did not sit as comfortably on his bald crown as had his old leather cap. Taran was grateful for Karl's wisdom, and gladly sought his counsel. It was Karl who gave him the thought, as the marshalling camps grew crowded, to send smaller, swifter bands directly to Kaer Dathal, rather than march from one comet to the next, with a force becoming ever more cumbersome. Lassa, Hevid, and Lonia would not leave Taran's vanguard, and stayed ever close at hand. But when Taran wrapped himself in a cloak and stretched on the frozen ground for rare moments of sleep, it was Karl who stood watch over him.
"You are the oaken staff I lean on," Taran said. "More than that," he laughed. "You are the whole sturdy tree, and a true warrior."
Karl, instead of beaming, looked wryly at him.
"Do you mean to honour me?" he asked. "Then say rather, I am a true grower of turnips, and a gatherer of apples. No warrior whatever, save that I am needed thus for a while. My garden longs for me, as much as I long for it," Karl added. "I left it unready for winter, and for that I will pay a sorry reckoning at spring planting."
Taran nodded. "We shall dig and weed together, true grower of turnips, and true friend." The watch fires flickered in the night. The horses stirred in their lines. About them, a mass of deep shadows, dark against darkness, lay sleeping warriors. The chill wind cut at Taran's face. He was suddenly weary to the marrow of his bones. He turned to Karl.
"My heart, too, will be easier," he said, "when I am once more an assistant pig-keeper."
Word reached Taran that King Smoit had raised a strong host among the Cantrev lords, and was now turning northward. The companions learned, too, that certain of Aron's liegemen had sent war parties across Istrad to harass the columns marching to Kaer Dathal. Taran's task thus grew more urgent, but he could do no more than press onward with all haste. The companions made their way to Comet Merin. For Taran, it had been among the fairest he had known in all his wanderings. Even now, amid the tumult of warriors arming, of neighing horses and shouting riders, the white, thatched cottages of the little village seemed to stand peaceful and apart. Taran galloped past the common fields ringed by hemlocks and tall firs. His heart laden with memories, he reined up at a familiar hut, whose smoking chimney betokened a warm fire within. The door opened, and out stepped a stocky, hale old man, garbed in a coarse brown robe. His iron-grey hair and beard were cropped short. His eyes were blue and undimmed.
"Well met,"
he called to Taran, and raised a huge hand crusted with dried clay.
"You left us a wanderer, and returned to us a war-leader. As for your skill in the latter, I have heard much. But I ask, have you forgotten your skill at my potter's wheel, or have I wasted my own to teach you?"
"Well met, Anlor Clayshaper," Taran answered, swinging down from Melinlass and fondly clasping the old potter's hand. "Wasted, in truth," Taran laughed, following him into the hut. "For the master had a clumsy apprentice. My skill lacks, but not my memory. What little I could learn I have not forgotten."
"Show me then,"
challenged the potter, scooping a handful of wet clay from a wooden trough. Taran smiled sadly and shook his head. "I halted only to give you greeting," he replied. "Now I labour with swords, not earthen bowls." Nevertheless, he paused. The hearthlight glowed on shelves and rows of pottery, of graceful wine jars, of ewers handsomely and lovingly crafted. Quickly, he took the cool clay and cast it upon the wheel which Anlor had begun to spin. Time pressed him too closely, Taran knew, yet as the work took form under his hands, for a moment he put down the burden of his other task. The days turned back, and there was only the whirring of the wheel and the shape of the vessel, born from the shapeless clay.
"Well done," said Anlor in a quiet voice, then added, "I have heard how smiths and weavers throughout the comets labour to give you arms and raiment. But my wheel cannot forge a blade, nor weave a warrior's cloak, and my clay is shaped only for peaceful tasks. Alas, I can offer nothing that will serve you now."
"You have given me more than all the others," Taran answered, "and I treasure it the most. My way is not the warrior's way. Yet, if I do not bear my sword now, there will be no place in Prydain for the usefulness and beauty of any craftsman's handiwork. And if I fail, I will have lost all I gained from you." His hand faltered, for Karl's booming voice was shouting his name. Taran sprang from the wheel and, while Anlor watched in alarm, strode out of the hut, calling a hurried farewell to the potter. Karl had already drawn his sword. In another moment, Lassa joined them. They galloped toward the camp a little way from Merin, as Karl hastily told Taran that the guard post had sighted a band of marauders.
"They shall soon be upon us," Karl warned. "We should meet them before they attack our trains. As a grower of turnips, I advise you to rouse a company of bowmen and a troop of good riders. Lassa and I shall try to lure them with a smaller band of warriors."
Quickly they set their plans. Taran rode ahead, calling to the horsemen and foot soldiers, who hastily caught up their weapons and followed after him. He ordered Ailanwy and Gurgi to safety among the carts. Without waiting to hear their protests, he galloped toward the fir forest covering the outlying hills. The marauders were armed more heavily than Taran had expected. Swiftly they sped down from the snow-covered ridge. At a sign from Taran, the bowmen raced and flung themselves into a shallow gully, and the mounted warriors of the comets wheeled to the charge. The riders met in a turmoil of hooves and clash of blades. Then Taran raised his horn to his lips. At the piercing, echoing signal, the bowmen rose from cover. It was, Taran knew, little more than a skirmish, but sharply and hotly fought. Only at the last, when Karl and Lassa's band drew off many of the foe, did the marauders break and flee. Yet it was the first battle Taran had commanded as a war leader for the Prince of Don. The comet folk had carried the day, with none of their number slain and only a few wounded. Though weary and drained of his strength, Taran's heart pounded with the joy of victory as he led the exulting warriors from the forest and back toward Merin. As he reached the hill crest, he saw flames and black billows of smoke. At first he thought the camp had taken fire. He spurred Melinlass at top speed down the slope. As he drew closer, as the crimson